Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's snap elections, called by Turkey's increasingly authoritarian leader Erdogan, who is seeking more power but now faces the biggest threat to his 15-year rule. Asla Bali, the director of UCLA's Center for Near East Studies and a professor of law at UCLA's School of Law, joins us to discuss the results of today's critical elections as they come in, which will decide the fate of democracy in that divided country and whether Turkey remains a credible member of the NATO alliance. We will discuss Erdogan's tough challenge of the center-left candidate, Muharrem Ince, who has revived Turkey's demoralized opposition, which is forced to operate under a state of emergency with little access to the media dominated by Erdogan and his ruling Islamist party. With Turkey's economy in a steep downturn since Erdogan called for the elections, he expected to win. We'll assess how the Kurdish vote for their candidate, who is in prison, is key, but subject to government repression, in a country polarized between Kurds and nationalists and the religious and secular. And with six journalists jailed for life, according to press monitoring groups, Erdogan's Turkey has become the world's biggest jailer of journalists. Then we will investigate the source of the immigration crisis on our southern border, which stems from the lack of personal security, rule of law, and citizen-based governance in Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, and Mexico, countries rife with corruption and beset by narco-traffickers and criminal gangs. Guadalupe Correa Cabrera, a professor of political science at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley, and the author of Los Zetas Incorporated, Criminal Corporations, Energy, and Civil War in Mexico, joins us to discuss her study at the Wilson Center, Trafficking in Persons, Irregular Immigration and Transnational Organized Crime in Central America and Mexico. Then finally, we will go to Moscow to speak with independent journalist Alexei Kovalev, who writes about propaganda, fake news, and Russian state media. He joins us to discuss his article at the New York Times, "The World Cup is Fun Except for the Russians Being Tortured," and how Putin, who has unleashed the FSB secret police on so-called dissidents, is using the popular success of the World Cup amongst Russians who are welcoming foreign guests as a cover for introducing unpopular pension reforms. And joining us now is Asla Bali, the director of the Center for Near East Studies and a professor of law at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asla Bali.
Thanks very much.
And Asla, at this point, it does look, I think 50% of the votes in, you may have better information than I do, already, the leader of Azerbaijan has congratulated Erdogan on a victory. My understanding is that there are more votes that could come in from areas that Muharrem Ince has a popular hold on. What's your take on the likely outcome here?
Yeah, on the presidential election, I think you're right that at this point it's still possible for there to be a shift, but the polls that have come back have created such a gap between Erdogan and Ince, Erdogan polling at 54%, Ince at 30%, roughly, that it does seem as if it's possible that Erdogan will win outright in the first round.
And that would avoid a runoff, which is obviously what he wants.
Exactly. So others had hoped as recently as yesterday, based on the incredible groundswell of support for Muharrem Ince, the Republican People's Party candidate, that we would be going to a second round. So I think many are looking at these results so far, at least, with disappointment.
Well, but if you're disappointed, you also are skeptical, are you not? Because under Erdogan, there's been enormous amounts of repression. There's still a state of emergency, total domination of the media by Erdogan and his Islamist party. So on the surface, none of it's fair. But isn't there a problem or the possibility of the key Kurdish vote being suppressed? Their candidate is campaigning from prison. And since there's a kind of state of emergency, the people like to come out to vote under the gun of the armed forces?
Absolutely. I mean, just to be very clear, these are neither free nor fair elections. There was almost no space for opposition candidates to campaign. As you point out, one of the most significant opposition candidates, Selahattin Demirtas, the head of the pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party, is campaigning from prison, where he's been detained for over a year with no evidence substantiating charges of his alleged support for terrorism other than political campaign speeches, which had absolutely no content supporting terrorism. There is a restriction on media, as you've already pointed out, in addition to the fact that there's almost total pro-AKP media ownership in Turkey. The few media sources that are willing to give voice to opposition candidates have been brought under tremendous pressure. Many of their editors-in-chief and editors and key columnists and journalists are also detained. So the notion that we're talking about an even playing field, of course, is completely false. Notwithstanding that, there were high hopes that we would go to a second round, just as a measure of how unpopular Erdogan has become, despite his total domination of the electoral field and circumstances under which it's almost, you know, unimaginable how you could mount an effective opposition against all of these odds. There has been a quite effective set of campaigns run against him through clever use of social media, through, you know, sets of innovative, ingenious, really, efforts. And the bottom line is the one thing that Erdogan faces by way of objective opposition that he's unable to manipulate directly is capital markets. And because the Turkish lira has lost over 20% of its value this year, because against the dollar, because the economy is clearly performing much less well, there's significant unemployment, inflation rate is very high. The basic story that Erdogan tells, which is one of economic growth under his leadership, is no longer compelling. It's the reason that he moved the elections early. You noted in your introduction that since he called for the snap elections, the economy has shown significant slowdown. He called for snap elections because had he waited the 18 months until the regularly scheduled elections in late 2019, he would have faced potentially significant contraction. Right now, he's been campaigning on a story of the economy grew 7% last year. Most people think those numbers are doctored, but you would not be able to pass a laugh test by the end of this year making that kind of a claim. So this was the last possible moment at which he could still try to sell his basic narrative, but it's coming apart, and the coalition that supported that narrative is coming apart, and notwithstanding the tremendous obstacles faced by opposition candidates, there have been significant inroads made, and therefore there were real hopes that we would be looking at a second round in the presidential elections. Only in that sense that I say that there will be some disappointment. As you say, there's a very high likelihood of tampering with elections. To begin with, again, returning to the basic conditions under which the AKP, the governing party of which Erdogan is the leader, controls all elements of the election. They also control polling places, where polling places are placed. They control the ballot boxes. They control the elections commission that determines whether an election has been fair or not. So all of the cards are in their hands. Of course, there are citizens that are observing at every ballot. There are external observers. But we've seen in previous elections that it's possible for the party, beyond the incredible control it exerts, to also tamper with results at the margins. So people are definitely looking out for that. People are trying their best to make sure that the ballot that goes in the box is the one that's counted in the end. And we'll see over the rest of today and the coming days, you know, stories emerge about just how much that strict definition of fairness, namely not actually rigging and stuffing the ballot boxes, whether at least that measure of fairness was able to be maintained.
And again, I'm speaking with Asla Bali, who's the director of the Center for Near East Studies at UCLA and a professor of law at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. Now, there was an earlier referendum, of course, where another power grab by Erdogan, and that was widely considered to be flawed. The Europeans refused to certify it. But guess who stepped in and congratulated Erdogan? None other than President Trump, the only Western leader, I think, that congratulated him on this earlier power grab. And here you have an incipient dictator destroying democracy, ruining the economy, basically breaking with NATO in buying Russian military equipment, which goes against NATO's into interoperability rules, and he's run an anti-American campaign demonizing America, and yet our president supports him. So what's going on?
Yeah, that requires an analysis of what's happening on the U.S. side of the equation. And, I mean, you pointed out that President Trump congratulated Erdogan. Of course, it's also widely known that he was amongst the first to congratulate Putin on his recent reelection. So, obviously, free and fair elections are not the standard by which Trump adjudicates circumstances under which he'll congratulate leaders worldwide. You know, it's anybody's guess what drives President Trump's personal conception of foreign policy, but for the reasons you've already pointed out, there are many changes that have occurred over the last 5 years or so in U.S.-Turkish relations that would lead one to expect an American president to be far less sanguine about Erdogan than Trump has been.
Well, apparently the Pentagon nervous about selling F-35s, the latest advanced American fighter plane, to the Turks, and there's a general sense that getting these missile, ground-to-air missile batteries from Russia has broken a kind of rule of NATO's, which is all of their equipment is supposed to be, you know, interoperable, I guess is the word they used. So is Trump not listening to his own defense people?
Look, at an earlier stage in the spring, when the Turkish military was overrunning Kurdish positions in northern Syria, and there was a real possibility that the Turkish military might move forward, advance on a position in the town of Manbij where Americans are stationed and where Americans have been supporting Kurdish fighters in the war on the Islamic State. The generals on the ground were saying, if you come any closer, we will end up engaging, meaning that you would have seen a circumstance in which you would have two NATO forces aligned against one another in an engagement in northern Syria. Obviously, a terrifying prospect. And even as generals were saying, we will not step back, and we are here, and we will defend our position, President Trump was saying, I'm pulling forces out of Syria. So it seems as if, certainly, there are lots of reasons to think that President Trump is not taking signals directly from the Pentagon, but rather pursuing his own set of policies in some instances that undercut positions being taken by his generals on the ground.
So what's the reason? There are reports that the Trump Organization has hotel deals with members of Erdogan's family, and of course his family are all sort of cutouts for all of the corruption that goes on. And it's worth noting that Erdogan has already built a massive palace for himself. I think it's got 105 bedrooms. And also he's built, I think, one of the biggest mosques in the world as well. And he's turning, along with the bill of particulars that I mentioned earlier, of all the reasons why our president should not support this guy's re-election. The other fundamental thing is as he gets rid of Turkish democracy, increases the Islamification of the country, does he not, particularly in terms of education?
Well, first of all, in Erdogan, yes, there has clearly been an effort undertaken by the state to shift specifically education, which is part of a broader project to basically alter the cultural direction of the country and shift the focus away from the kinds of secularizing reforms for which Turkey was known in the 20th century in the direction of a much more religious orientation, which has been manifest in not only the curricula in schools, but also the fact that we have an incredible flourishing of religious schools as compared to regular public schools in the country for K-12 education. So that's definitely the case. One of the things, returning to your earlier question about President Trump and what direction he's taking and what might be driving this admiration, as we saw in his North Korea summit in Singapore, he seems to genuinely admire those who are able to fully control their population through repressive means. And it may very well be that it's that affinity more than anything else that's driving Trump's apparent warmth for Erdogan. I think it would be hard to imagine a different American president taking the tone that Trump has taken. But that's true on so many fronts that really it's more an analysis of what's happening on the U.S. side than an analysis of Turkey or even bilateral relations. I think there's just something specific about President Trump and his affinities that seems to drive him in the direction of the Dutertes and the Erdogans.
But there is, hotel deals with Trump, the Trump Organization and Turkish partners, including members of Erdogan's extended family?
Yes, there are definitely Trump properties in Turkey, but it's possible that that's a principal driver, but it's equally conceivable that there are deeper affinities that are really about the way in which Trump imagines or reimagines American foreign policy and the nature of his own rule. I mean, really, it is a break with most of the sort of political orientation that we've seen consistently across parties in terms of approach to foreign policy of the United States. And that's been such an enormous sea change that while it's possible, it may be an explanation that's as simple as personal self-interest on the part of the Trump family. It's also equally conceivable. I don't know if he has significant interests in Hungary or the Philippines. The overall trend is so pronouncedly favorable to precisely this kind of populist authoritarian that it seems as if there may be a broader explanation.
Well, we know that there's a peculiar affection for Putin, and we don't know the extent to why that is so. And presumably the Mueller inquiry will hopefully shed some light on what's behind that relationship. So the fact that Turkey's moving closer towards Putin, or Erdogan's moving closer towards Putin, I can't imagine that bothers Trump, since he's moving closer towards Putin and is actually going to conduct a summit with him, even though the European allies want to sanction Putin as opposed to reward him. But the fact
in other words, Erdogan is not the only person straining ties with NATO partners.
Right.
In the equation of bilateral relations between the United States and Turkey, both are seeming to move in a sort of similar direction.
Right.
In the case of the United States, it's very, very hard to account for.
Right. But the fact that Erdogan's moving closer to Iran, do you think that gets Trump's attention? Because Trump and some of his advisors are very hawkish on Iran.
It is an interesting question, and it's almost impossible to make sense if you look at the whole tableau of positions that the Trump administration has taken. Many things don't fit with the other. I mean, yes, it's true that Turkey at the moment in the broader configurations that in the Middle East and in Syria is in a kind of loose alliance, let's say, with those that are on the Iranian side as well. But that's, of course, even more pronouncedly true of Russia. And again, as you've already pointed out, the Trump administration has been very comfortable giving signals of warmth and foreign policy alignment to the Russians, notwithstanding that relationship with Iran. So I presume that there's some thinking at this point about how one might be able to draw these things together in a summit with Putin if that were to happen, or in some other way. Turkey is not a driver of that relationship either with Iran or with Russia. It's really reactive to circumstances in the region, specifically what's happening in Syria, what's happening with attempted Kurdish independence referendum in Iraq, the alliance between Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. A lot of this has been not Turkey having a forward-thinking, clear policy towards the region any longer, something that this party was once associated with a decade ago, but rather being deeply reactive. So I wouldn't describe the Turkish-Iranian relationship as a deep and strategic one at the moment. I'm sure if configurations were to change on the ground, or if there were to be an agreement between the United States and Russia concerning the future of Syria, or how they will calibrate their own very different approaches to Iran, that Turkey would fall in once again in a reactive way.
Well, just in the last minute, is there a possibility, though, that Turkey has a trump card to play, which is how many Syrian refugees they're holding and whether they can pull the cork out of that bottle and let more immigrants in these vast camps, millions of them in the neighborhood of Syria from all the displaced Syrians and also from Iraqis and Afghans as well, flood into Europe as they did a few summers ago. Obviously, that whole issue has put the leadership in Germany of Angela Merkel's in jeopardy as we speak. Is that the leverage? In other words, after assuming that Erdogan wins this election, which has probably been rigged, the Europeans aren't going to be happy. But on the other hand, he holds a gun to the head, doesn't he, with immigration?
Well, let me just say a couple of things on this. First, I think we have to wait to see what the evidence is on the rigging front. It's quite possible, but there's also a parliamentary election taking place at the moment, and that is a place to keep our eyes on, where there's a lot more sort of in play, where you have a coalition of the Republican People's Party together with the Nationalist Party, the so-called Good Party, and another small Islamist party. You have the HDP contending. It looks like the HDP may well get over the threshold, which would mean that it is extremely likely that you're going to have a much more divided parliament. And there's still the possibility, although, again, this is where the rigging questions might arise more directly, but there's still a possibility that the AKP might not enjoy a majority, although at the moment it looks as if they might. In any case, so there's a lot still going on with respect to the election itself, and I think it's premature to say what degree of the results is or is not attributable to rigging. But we will know more about that in the days to come. As for the refugees, honestly, Europe has been so unbelievably unprincipled and divided. There's been no pressure brought to bear on Turkey, frankly. I mean, with the exception of small bilateral spats over, you know, much narrower issues, there's almost no pressure being brought to bear on Turkey with respect to the decline in democracy, with respect to incipient authoritarianism, et cetera. And so there isn't really any reason to play that so-called Trump card. There's really nothing that the Turks need to do, because there's no pressure from Europe for them to resist at the moment. And they have a number of other objectives, Europe having been completely sidelined with respect to Syria itself, Syria proper. So many of those refugees, I mean, there's a, you know, there may well be a goal of returning, repatriating some of those refugees and producing a sort of pro-Erdogan swath of population in Syria. Certainly, there's been a remarkable shifting demographic in the parts of northern Syria where Turkey commands a tremendous amount of sway, including in the city of Afrin, where you see, you know, Syrian Arab citizens being bused in to take over homes recently vacated of their Kurdish residents following the Turkish onslaught there. So, you know, there are many different configurations that may emerge. I think that the refugee Trump card, as you described it, with respect to Europe, is not the principal or most interesting way to think about what the future looks like for the millions of Syrian refugees and other refugees that are in Turkey at the moment.
Well, Asma Bali, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Asma Bali, who's the director of the UCLA Center for Near East Studies and a professor of law at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back investigating the source of the immigration crisis on our southern border. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Guadalupe Correa Cabrera, who's a professor at the Slaa School of Policy and Government at George Mason University, whose research focuses on Mexico-U.S. relations, organized crime, immigration, border security, and human trafficking. She was recently the principal investigator of a research grant to study organized crime and trafficking in persons in Central America and along Mexico's eastern immigration routes, supported by the Department of State's Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons, the president of the Association of Borderland Studies, and a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Her latest book is Los Zetas Incorporated, Criminal Corporations, Energy, and Civil War in Mexico. Welcome to Background Briefing, Guadalupe Correa Cabrera.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure being with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you for joining us. And this is, of course, I what brought this to my attention, I spoke with the former head of the INS the other day under President Bill Clinton, who actually signed the Flores Agreement. And I mentioned that the former head of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson, said that no matter how tough Trump gets, and he's always talking about being tough on the border and building his wall and being tough, and he's said the most outrageous things about Mexicans and also the most outrageous things about why the Democrats support MS-13 and all of this these outrageous claims that he makes. But at the end of the day, what Jay Johnson said is no matter how tough Trump is, he's not dealing with the problem itself. And as long as we don't deal with conditions in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, he didn't actually mention Mexico, but I think you should include Mexico, we'll get nowhere. So I take it you share that belief.
I believe that's totally correct. If you just build walls, create technology to prevent people from entering a country where they, when they are escaping extremely deteriorated economic conditions, plus the security situation, but also, affects people and their families. And also, you're closing the border, but you're accepting and providing jobs for some people selectively. These people cannot go back and forth as before. You don't increase the number of visas or temporary visas. So people are running from a situation or escaping from a situation of extreme deprivation, economic and in terms of security. Therefore, if the countries involved, the United States, Mexico, Central America, the governments, do not sit together and come up with an agreement to improve the conditions. These conditions are not, just exclusive of one country or two countries or the United States itself. Requires an agreement where where these countries, talk and try to discuss what can they do together to promote the growth of the region. One thing that's important to remember is that Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador in the last century, during the civil wars in this country that coincided with a period of Cold War, also involved the intervention of the United States, also contributed to the extreme economic crisis that has not been addressed until today. Economic conditions that, and also the deportation policy of the United States, are bringing a lot of people back that were the young people that went with their families during the civil wars, also escaping from the violence at that time, promoted by the United States in some way at the same time. So these people were deported from gangs in the United States. They were deported massively to the countries of origin, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, mainly El Salvador and Honduras. And the lack of opportunities, the deteriorated economic conditions, the lack of growth also, and the lack of capacity of Central American governments to provide these United States and jobs also extended. Also, this coincided with extreme levels of corruption. This extended the gang model, and this model is affecting its own population. The MS-13 problem is not a national security problem for the United States. It's a big national security problem for the countries of the Northern Triangle, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, where these people that have had no opportunities, just have found the space within the gangs, MS-13, Barrio 18, and other gangs that derive from these big groups. They have extended this model and affected the poorest of the society. This is not against the United States. Of course, we have MS-13 members or members of other gangs in the United States affecting the country, but this is probably just a way to understand the problem to justify or spreading out like a problem that would represent supposedly a national security threat to the United States to justify zero tolerance policies that would make possible greater numbers of deportations of people that are in the United States today. But yes, what Jay Johnson has said is definitely true. with this type of zero tolerance policy, if people are provided with jobs, when they cross the border, they're going to find a smuggler. They're going to find a way to make it wherever, through tunnels, through the sea, through corruption on both sides of the border, Mexico and the United States. These people coming from Central America and also from Mexico are going to find a way to make it to the United States. No matter how many fences or how much technology or how many bits in the ground you're adding to protect a border. We need to address the conditions of the country, the situation that involves that involves all the countries that I'm talking about, and of course the United States. That was also part of the crisis that these countries have experienced because also of the geopolitical interest during the times of the war, of the Cold War, and today as well.
Since you are talking to us, Guadalupe, from Mexico, obviously next weekend's elections will be critical. It looks as though, according to the polls, it's going to be a major shift underway with AMLO, a sort of a perennial candidate, if you will, who's always been denied elections. I think he's probably won at least one other because of the vote rigging, but it looks as though he has a sufficient lead that he may well become the new leader of Mexico. He's not going to cooperate with Trump like the current leader is, even though he refuses to pay for Trump's wall. But in terms of crime and lack of governance and lack of security, my understanding of those are the very issues we're talking about, which beset Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, also beset Mexico, and they are the real subtext in this election, are they not? People are sick of corruption. And by the way, there have been 121 murders of political candidates, along with 400 attacks against political candidates since September of 2017 in Mexico. So it's even hazardous for your health running for election in Mexico.
Yes, it's a very important subject. The elections, as you mentioned, if everything goes well, if the candidate is not killed, as many others local candidates have been killed, over 120, and this has been a very violent election. Today, the levels of violence have been, as high as in any other period of the contemporary history of the country. And I don't believe that there is a possibility that fraud, a big possibility that fraud is going to be committed. I think we need to see, to watch and see what López Obrador and his team, if he wins the election, will do with regards to border security and immigration cooperation. People are sick of corruption and sick of the response, of the very light response the government has had with the approach Trump has had with Mexico. And they are probably expecting that López Obrador and his team will have a different attitude about this. López Obrador, during the campaign, has not been very direct with regards to his actual approach to the United States. He has been very careful, and he has not revealed very much what he's planning to do with regards to the current approach to immigration policy and Mexico's southern border. The Mexican past administrations, the PAN and the PRI administration, were very cooperative with the United States. Still today, even with Trump winning the election and with all the statements he has made against Mexico, Mexico has to pay a wall, and Mexicans being rapers, being people who commit crimes in the United States, even though Mexico has maintained its level of cooperation at the highest level. They've been deporting Central American migrants, and they've been the guardians of the southern border. I am not sure what López Obrador is going to do. However, considering his platform, his approach, his ideologies, I believe that this cooperation will change substantially. In what direction, I am not sure. I am not sure if it's going to be a confrontational relationship with the United States, but definitely my firm belief, it's going to be a more tense relationship. We're going to see two men that are not going to negotiate in friendly ways, probably, and are not used to do that in these terms. López Obrador and needs also to address the people who will vote for him and who are expecting a different attitude towards the United States and towards many other subjects. People don't want more of the same, and this is why the lead that he has reflects an attitude for change. People are hoping for change, and if he doesn't provide them this change, he's going to have it very difficult. So I believe this is going to be a very tense period in terms of the United States-Mexico border security and immigration cooperation, and we will see what happens. At this point, it's difficult to know. As I said, Andres Manuel has not been clear with regards to that, but I expect a substantial change in the relationship.
Well, I understand that Mexico stops about 400,000 Central American immigrants or refugees heading north to the U.S. That's about half of the of those heading north, and you know, the obviously many are fleeing, if not most are fleeing from violence, from gangs, etc. The iconic photograph of the young 2-year-old Honduran girl crying as the Border Patrol frisks her mother. It turns out that she may actually be more of a economic refugee than a than somebody that's applying for political asylum. So we don't know what AMLO López Obrador is going to do about whether Mexico will continue its policy of curtailing immigration. But nobody seems to be talking about what to deal with, how to make life more miserable for Guatemalans, for Hondurans, and for El Salvadorans, and the U.S., ironically, is turning a blind eye to what's happening in Nicaragua with the repression from the Sandinista leader there, who is deeply unpopular, is murdering his own people in the streets, using government thugs to murder people, the Maduro is doing in Venezuela. And even killed a 1-year-old baby. My understanding is one of the reasons why the U.S. is not making a stand against Ortega's dictatorship in Nicaragua is that they basically don't want any more refugees. They want, you know, stability, even if it's not the kind of stability that the U.S. is supposed to stand for. How do you see it?
It's a very interesting observation. It is true the United States today has not intervened or has not made any, you know, big statement with regards to what is happening in Nicaragua with Daniel Ortega and the popular mobilization against the regime that is considered to be authoritarian, and it's considered to be corrupted, and the conditions of the people showed, and the opposition and the people of Nicaragua are not happy with the current administration. Of course, the United States also they have not talked about the electoral fraud of Honduras, but they are more concerned with what is happening in their country, right? They see it as a homeland security issue, and they, of course, I agree with you that they would not want to have more refugees from Nicaragua. However, the conditions or the situation in Nicaragua is getting, you know, quite deteriorated. So the United States would also have some intention to get this problem solved or to have an influence of this problem to be solved. Because even if they don't do anything, the migration can also add to what the problems that they have today. This is what has happened in Venezuela. Venezuelans are fleeing the country massively because of the conditions that they are living with the internal situation. So by the United States not doing anything, it also doesn't help them. However, it seems that Donald Trump is more interested in other issues and in addressing the situation he has now and addressing his popular base. He promised a wall. He understands that certain type of statements, a certain type of discourse is going to maintain its base and his base. And we know that we're having elections later on this year. And what he really wants is to maintain his base and to deal with certain subjects in a way to continue and to assure that he's going to be able to finish his administration and do the things that he wants to do. So today he has priorities. I believe that that the United States really would have interest in Nicaragua. Nicaragua is a strategic place where other countries like Russia and China might have interest. I believe that they're going to deal with that eventually. But as of today, the discourse and the national agendas the priorities are centered on Central American migrants, Northern Triangle countries, a wall between Mexico and the United States, and a discourse that has given Donald Trump a lot of electoral benefits. And he has to maintain that because of the election later on this year. But I believe that Nicaragua, we will see more action probably in Nicaragua because of the fact that it's a place in the hemisphere where other nations also have interest in. So I believe we need to wait to see what would be the United States approach with the country, which is important and very interesting. Also, we have to see that the approach that the United States is having today with Central America is also connected to the approach the president is having and the discourse that is right now in the public sphere in the United States related to gangs, as I mentioned before. So now we are observing a concentration on this, and we'll see what's going to happen next, because Venezuela and Nicaragua are countries that are experiencing extreme conditions and an extreme economic deterioration, and nobody can in the region, things cannot stay this way. I know that in terms of Venezuela, the situation in Venezuela, we have waited a long time. The United States also has not done much, to intervene in the country, but also there are other conditions and situations in the country where the intervention or a direct participation today is probably not the wisest thing to do.
Sure. Well, just in closing, of course, the president's outrageous rhetoric about immigrants from Central America infesting this country and saying that the Democrats want these MS-13 gang members to come into the United States so that they'd vote for the Democrats. And he recently met with families of Americans whose family members were killed by immigrants from south of the border. It turns out that a Cato Institute study indicates that homegrown crime in America is twice as much as that committed by undocumented immigrants, and three times as much as committed by documented immigrants to this country. So it would be very helpful in this country if the opposition, the Democrats, stood up and actually stopped accepting the outrageous rhetoric coming from our president. But in any case, I thank you for joining us, Guadalupe Cabrera.
Thank you very much, Ian. It was a pleasure, and have a very good day.
You too.
Great Sunday.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Guadalupe Correa Cabrera, who is a professor at the SLAR School of Policy and Government at George Mason University's research focuses on Mexico-U.S. relations, organized crime, immigration, border security, and human trafficking. She was recently the principal investigator of a research grant to study organized crime and trafficking in persons in Central America and along Mexico's eastern immigration routes, supported by the Department of State's Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons. The president of the Association of Borderland Studies and a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Her latest book is Los Zetas Incorporated, Criminal Corporations, Energy and Civil War in Mexico. And she joined us from Mexico. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back and go to Moscow to speak with an independent journalist who writes about propaganda, fake news, and Russian state media. We're talking about his article in the New York Times, "The World Cup is Fun Except for the Russians Being Tortured." Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Moscow is Alexei Kovalev, who's a Russian journalist who writes about propaganda, fake news, and Russian state media. He's the founder and editor of NoodleRemover.news, a Russian-language fact-checking and anti-propaganda website. And he has an article at the New York Times, "The World Cup is Fun, Except for Russians Being Tortured." Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexei Kovalev.
Good evening from Moscow, and I guess it's morning for you.
It is morning here in California, but my understanding is that things are going very well. Russians are enjoying the World Cup. They're being very hospitable to the foreigners, and everybody's having a great time, except for so-called dissidents who Putin has unleashed the FSB on them, and some of what you've reported is pretty grim. Does anybody care? Obviously, there isn't much independent media in there. So, are the Russian people aware of some of the people that you've written about being tortured by the FSB?
Well, frankly, there's just one independent publication that's consistently covering these things, like police brutality, because it's their niche. It's called Media Zona, and they've been covering this case throughout. But other publications, well, it's not that they're staying away from it, from controversial topics like that, but it's just that they're hooked on the news cycle, and they can't be glued to a single topic like that. And it's been dragging on for months. I mean, these people have been detained. Most of them were detained last year. And they've been in detention ever since. And there's just one or two publications that have been covering this case, and several other connected cases to this one. I just wanted to get the word out, because otherwise, it's the way Russia works, and the way you can attract enough attention to a case is that you get the word out to the international media, because that's just the way it works. They are reading very carefully in the Kremlin. They subscribe to all the major publications, like the New York Times. So one way to make sure that people in the Kremlin are aware that this case isn't going to disappear from the public eye is to get the word out.
Right, but you've got the word out via the New York Times. Does that put a target on your back?
Well, I mean, I'm an investigative journalist, so. And I've been doing this for over a decade now. I have a habit of looking behind my back all the time, but it's not something that would put you in real danger, because there are topics that will definitely put a target on your back, and so you will be in danger of physical assault or persecution. But it's not one of those things. If I were investigating some corruption in the higher echelons of power, or investigating members of Vladimir Putin's family, that would put me in much more considerable danger than this article. So I'm thank you for worrying, but
well, I just don't want to get you into trouble. But now the U.S. State Department have put out a list of their concerns about particularly four Ukrainians who've been imprisoned. One of them, of course, is a film director that is on a hunger strike. They're also, of course, a Jehovah's Witness and five members of the Church of Scientology. I'm not sure I'm going to lose too much sleep over that, although that's not politically correct thing to say. But the people that you're talking about, particularly this 26-year-old anti-fascist activist who's being tortured by the FSB, they're members of Antifa, the anti-fascist group. I didn't realize it operated inside Russia as well as here in the United States. So tell us about what's going on with these, because I understand that Putin didn't want, first of all, at a lot of Russian soccer games, and a lot of hooligans who the state turns a blind eye to. But Putin, who supports the St. Petersburg team, which is amongst the rowdiest of all, not to mention, of course, the British soccer hooligans, they're pretty ridiculous and disgraceful too. But it seems like he's gotten those people to behave. At the same time, he's gone after people like the Antifa people. So explain what's going on.
Okay, so let me add a bit of nuance to this, because I'm not quite sure.
You're not quite sure what? Did we lose you?
I'm not quite sure that he's even aware of these people's existence, because I'm pretty sure that he himself didn't give the order to persecute and torture these people. That's a self-replicating system of violence and repression, because the FSB is a secret service like any other, and they need to show results. So they need to demonstrate their usefulness to the state. And so they're just picking on easy targets. So there's one organization, and leftist activists like these guys have been on their radar for a long enough time. And it's not like, the Russian Antifa is something very different from the American ones. It's just they share the same umbrella term to define them. But these guys, like anyone who's involved in any unsanctioned political activity on any spectrum, and it doesn't really make any difference whether you're a far-right activist or a far-left, you are going to be on the FSB's radar, and they're just going to use you as fodder for their own career advancement. Because they need to show results. Like, we busted this terrorist cell, and they were preparing acts of terrorism to the World Cup, which is obviously very important to the state as a PR exercise. There it is. And even though there's enough publicity by now, I'm not sure if the state is. It's just not the way the system is built. It's gonna fail even at considerable public pressure. All these public campaigns to release these activists or another, it's actually hurting these activist chances of being released, because neither Vladimir Putin nor she is.
Sorry, I think we lost you again, did we? Are you back? You're sort of fading in and out there. I don't know whether there's a way to get closer to the mic or whether it's the connection. Are you still with us, Alexei?
Yes, I am.
Okay, good.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, yeah. One of the things I wanted to run by you is that I understand that the World Cup has been very successful for Putin, and the Russians are enjoying it and welcoming foreign guests. But isn't it also being used by Putin as a cover to introduce these very unpopular so-called pension reforms, where essentially people are not going to get their pensions as early as they used to?
Oh, yes. The joke on Russian Twitter is that each Russian goal raises the pension age by 1 year and the tax by 1%, because all the attention of all the world media and the domestic media in Russia are on the World Cup, and other matters like domestic policy are getting less and less coverage, and so you can slip in all these unpopular measures while everyone and the media and the public are glued to the TVs. So yeah, that's another factor.
Well, is there any sense that that the hostility that's been directed at the West, or at least the sense of injury that Putin puts out to the Russian people, that I'm going to restore our greatness, which has been maligned and reduced by the West and by NATO moving, encroaching on our normal previous sphere of influence, and the general sense of victimization that Putin feels, or at least he projects that idea that I'm going to restore Russia's greatness, which has been sort of stolen by the West, if you will. How does that reconcile with having a bunch of people from the West enjoying themselves? In other words, as Putin tries to make more of an enemy of the West, what's happening with the World Cup would seem to play against that.
Actually, not, because, again, there's nuance. And if you listen closely to the message that the state TV is broadcasting, they keep repeating that we only have a problem with the government. We're not against the common people, and we are welcoming the people from all over the world with open arms. And that's actually what's happening. So I'm not going to discount that, and it's actually quite that's one of the more positive aspects of what's happening now in Moscow is that all those years of toxic propaganda on state TV can be undone with a few weeks of parking in the streets with people all over the world. And you can see that Russians are actually quite eager to welcome all these people, and they're being very helpful and receptive to other people's cultures. It's one thing that there's all this propaganda on state TV, but when you actually meet people from other countries and you're eager to show them the good side of your country, that's what's happening now. But that doesn't remove the tension between the governments on the government level. But it's not like, you know, the state TV doesn't demonize the people. It's just the government. They are focusing on specific persons like presidents and foreign ministers, but not the common people.
Well, just in the last minute, our president, Donald Trump, can't wait to meet with Vladimir Putin. He's going to be probably going to visit Europe soon, and he'll either go to Russia to meet him or meet him somewhere, either before or after he meets the Queen of England. So are you looking forward to our president breaking bread with his favorite despot, Vladimir Putin?
I can only see that Donald Trump's figure is causing a lot of anxiety and confusion in Putin's circle, because he's so unpredictable. Because he's Putin values the stability, this notion of stability has been his religion, has been his mantra for his several terms as the president. It's stability, predictability. We need to know what's happening, and we need to know to count. We have to count on people acting in a more or less predictable way. You can be hostile to us, but please do that in a consistent way.
I see. I get it.
But Donald Trump, yeah.
All right. Well, there's got to be some consistency to his erratic nature. I thank you for joining us, Alexei Kovalev. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I'm speaking with Alexei Kovalev, who's in Moscow. He's a Russian journalist who writes about propaganda, fake news, and Russian state media. He's the founder and editor of NoodleRemover.news, a Russian-language fact-checking and anti-propaganda website. And he has an article at the New York Times, "The World Cup is Fun, Except for the Russians Being Tortured." This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Alarivalat. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.